alike no matter what I did. I went to this small private school and the kids there were super mean to me. There was no escape. They were cruel and it probably sounds like an exaggeration, but I felt tortured by them. I begged my parents to let me go to a different school, a bigger one where at least I could have actually faded into the background. But they would say this was the best school for college prep, blah, blah, and that if I just dressed or acted different, people would like me more. I don't know why, but being teased about not having sex really bothered me. Maybe because it was such an invasion of my most personal space. I felt like Hester Prynne in reverse walking around with a big V on my chest. I felt so rejected in so many ways. 3 years out of college, I was still a virgin. I felt behind, like it was too late to join in, and that was really hanging me up. So finally I did it. I was out one night with work friends and I got really drunk and had sex with the lead singer of this band. In the back of a limo, actually. That probably seems awful, but it was pretty okay. Kathy wasn't the only client I've had who's held her nose and jumped into the deep end of sex. I kept listening. I felt like I joined the world that night, she said. My whole life, it was like no one noticed me, except for my parents, or maybe the kids in high school, and they never liked what they saw. Then all of a sudden, I had something people wanted. Sex. Yeah. Is that what you wanted? I wanted to be wanted. You wanted to be wanted, I reflected back. I'm not proud of it, Kathy admitted. There's a serious gap in some stuff I do. I'll get into something with somebody and I'll know it's a bad idea, but it's just so easy. It's hard to resist this power handed to me. Power. The power to not feel unattractive and insecure, the power to feel special. And if a man doesn't want you, you feel unspecial. If someone doesn't want me, I feel awful. My confidence goes down. If there isn't a guy in my life, it's like a desert to me. Each person who wants me feels like an oasis. Like maybe this will be the last person to want me. I feel like I have to drink up. I have to take whatever I can get. If I don't find someone, I view it as being rejected by everyone. Kathy continued. I feel like I have to keep hooking up and see what sticks, she said. I'm not sure anything sticks like that, I said. Listening to myself say this, I feel like I should have known better than to listen to those people from high school, or to still be listening. But even now, if I want to stay home and work on my writing, it can't just be that. It means I'm becoming the crazy cat lady who will never find anyone. I constantly feel like everyone I meet started all this sooner, like everyone else always wins. At some point, it needs to just be enough. I caught up. I'm not 17 anymore. That's right. You're 27. 27? Hearing that, it's hard to believe I'm that old. And saying all this out loud, I have never said all of this to anyone, ever. It's embarrassing to hear me say how much this still controls me. I try not to think about it. I try to keep it in the back of my mind. When is this going to stop running my life? When you get this story out of the back of your mind, I said. There is a stereotype that psychologists are only interested in childhood memories. Childhood is important, but more and more, I am curious about what went on in high school. High school and our 20s are not only the time when we have our most self-defining experiences. Study after study shows they are also the time when we have our most self-defining memories. Adolescence is a time of many firsts, including our first attempt to form life stories. As we become capable of and interested in abstract thought, we start to put together stories about who we are and why. As our social networks expand across our teens and 20s, we repeat these stories to others and to ourselves. We use them to feel a sense of coherence as we move from place to place. The stories we tell about ourselves become facets of our identity. They reveal our unique complexity. All at once, they say something about friends, family, and culture. They say something about why we live as we do from year to year. I often help clients build professional identities by crafting stories about themselves that make sense, stories they can take around to job interviews. Personal stories about relationships are much trickier. Without resumes to organize our experiences with friends and lovers, or interviews that require us to reflect, our most intimate, self-defining memories can be pieced together in strange, even painful ways. Though some of these stories may be left untold, they are no less meaningful or powerful. Research and clinical experience suggests that these untold stories are most often about shame. The power of these untold personal stories is that, like for Kathy, they can loop silently in our minds without anyone, sometimes even ourselves, knowing about them. The stories are often found hiding, as Kathy said, in the gaps between what we plan to do and what we actually do, or between what happens and what we tell people about what happens. Yet these stories are the bits of identity with perhaps the greatest potential for change. Later, we will hear about how personality can change in our 20s, and it can, but it cannot change as quickly or as dramatically as the stories we tell about ourselves. Life stories with themes of ruin can trap us. Life stories that are triumphant can transform us. So part of what I do with clients like Kathy is help them tell their stories. Then we change them. Our stories need to be edited and revised over time, I told Kathy. You of all people ought to understand that. Yeah, seriously. Tell me what you know about editing your stories for children. Oh, that's the most important part. When you write a story, there are probably some good instincts there, but you're blinded by the feelings of the moment. When you look back on a story later, you can be more objective. A story you wrote may have made sense to you at the time you wrote it, but it has to make sense for everyone who reads it. You can see where it doesn't make sense. That's right. The story you are telling yourself now is a first draft left over from adolescence. It doesn't make sense to me. It doesn't, Kathy half stated and half asked. No, it doesn't. You aren't behind. You aren't unwanted. When are you going to stop dating down? Some of the guys I date are good looking, I'll have you know, Kathy responded playfully. I'm not talking about looks. I'm sure some of these men are perfectly handsome and nice, but you never challenge them to take you seriously. I'm talking about dating down to an old, low, inaccurate version of yourself. I am. It's like I'm still that untouchable everybody said I was, like I'm still 17. A lot has happened since then. 20-something women and men who are dating down, or working down for that matter, usually have untold or at least unedited stories. These stories originated in old conversations and experiences, and so they change only through new conversations and experiences. As Kathy's therapist, I had a lot of catching up to do. After years of listening to her parents, the kids from high school, and her iPod, Kathy sometimes barely noticed my words, or even her own. Then finally, she came in and said, I've been working up the courage to ask you something. It's the scariest, most embarrassing question I've ever asked anyone. I sat waiting for what felt like a long time. How do you see me? Kathy asked, eyes brimming with tears. This simple question left me with a hollow feeling in my throat. I knew it came from a deep sense of not being seen, from no one ever really looking at Kathy and telling her what they saw. I also knew it meant she was ready to have someone help her rewrite her story. I told Kathy I saw her as a person who'd been made to feel too much and less than all at the same time. I told her I was concerned that if she kept dating whoever came along, she might just marry whoever came along at 31 or 34. We spent many months talking about who she was now. A 20-something who'd survived years of teenage rejection and emerged as an enthusiastic and beloved teacher, a budding writer, a beautiful and desirable young woman, a Korean-American with special knowledge of what it means not to be seen. We spent even more months helping her shift from being wanted to wanting. Kathy had never thought about what she wanted or needed in a partner. She never thought she could do the wanting. She never thought she could take charge of her love life. I feel like I've realized this isn't some game, Kathy said. I'm at the point in my life where my next relationship could be my last one. I mean, let's get real. Yes, let's, I said. Kathy slowed down with men. She took some time in therapy to think about the qualities that were important to her and to consider what kind of relationship would make her feel good. She started to view dating and sex as enjoyable but serious undertakings where she could learn something about what she wanted in a mate. She started to see that men wanted to be with her, even if she wasn't offering sex up front. I never thought I could be in relationships like these, she said. Kathy is still dating, so I don't know what kind of relationship she will ultimately choose. but she makes better decisions on Friday and Saturday nights, ones that are no longer driven by conversations between her and the kids from high school, between her and her parents, or between her iPod and herself. Kathy has new voices in her head, mine, her best friends, her students, and her own. And these are the people she talks to now. These are the people she listens to now. Her story is being revised. Being and like. People love those who are like themselves. Aristotle, philosopher. What counts in making a happy marriage is not so much how compatible you are, but how you deal with incompatibility. Leo Tolstoy, writer. Eli was part of the Blue Shirt Brigade that streams out of the BART stations and into downtown San Francisco every Monday through Friday at about 8:45 a.m. Each time I saw him, he had on pressed khakis, a dry-cleaned Oxford shirt of some color between pale sky and navy ink, and a holster with various high-tech accoutrements. Like many men who go to psychotherapy, Eli was sent by his girlfriend, who thought he partied too much. In our first session, Eli dutifully reported his marching orders, but it soon became clear he had other things on his mind. Eli shifted around on the couch and fidgeted with his BlackBerry a lot. He seemed uncomfortable with his own thoughts. He would sit silent for moments at a time. Most clients hate periods of silence because they feel on the spot, but I could often tell that Eli punctuated quiet moments out of concern for me, even though I was the one who was used to them. Over some months, in a roundabout way, Eli spoke of his own reservations about his girlfriend. She didn't laugh much. She focused endlessly on her dissertation rather than going out and doing things. She seemed somewhat subdued. It bothered Eli that when they went to see his family, it took her a while to feel at ease with everyone, and even when she did, she rarely joined in on the big laughs or the intensely competitive board games. He thought maybe she was depressed. When Eli said something critical about his girlfriend, he quickly undid it, softening any remark by reminding me how sweet she was. He worried about hurting her feelings, even though she could not hear us. Eli and his girlfriend had gotten together quickly, having sex and setting a routine before they really got to know each other. Clearly there was intimacy and loyalty, but I don't think they liked each other very much. From what I could tell, Eli's girlfriend spent her therapy hours being concerned about who Eli was, and I know that Eli spent his therapy hours reluctantly having second thoughts about her. He wanted to be with someone who liked to be playful and someone who enjoyed going out and having fun with family and friends. He imagined someone who woke up happy and headed out to the park for a run. "What is it you like about your girlfriend?" I asked one day. "She's really pretty, and we have good sex." This was followed by a long pause. "Looks and sex. I'm not sure that's enough to sustain a relationship." "Yeah, I don't know. I guess I want someone more... maybe someone more like yourself?" "Well, that's embarrassing. It makes me sound like I'm in love with myself." "Eli, compatibility is not some sort of crime." "It's not?" he chuckled. "No, it's actually a really good plan." Eli and his girlfriend were not a particularly good match, but this was not clear to them. They were both good-looking, they were both Jewish and Democrats, they had the same friends and good sex, and the rest they worked around. Both were kind-hearted people who wanted to be in a relationship, and they avoided conflict to keep each other happy. Meanwhile, his faithfulness verged on obedience, and her steadiness could be seen as doggedness. At some point, Eli told me that he and his girlfriend were going to Nicaragua. I was thrilled. Traveling in a third-world country is the closest thing there is to being married and raising kids. You have glorious hikes and perfect days on the beach. You go on adventures you would never try or enjoy alone, but you also can't get away from each other. Everything is unfamiliar. Money is tight or you get robbed. Someone gets sick or sunburned. You get bored. It is harder than you expected, but you were glad you didn't just sit home. Provided Eli did not pop the question by some picturesque waterfall, this was exactly what he and his girlfriend needed. They needed to see how they traveled together. When Eli returned, he was crestfallen. Under the chronic stress of Nicaragua, he and his girlfriend had become more extreme versions of who they already were. She wanted to go on day-long walks to the ruins, while Eli wanted to hang out in the towns and restaurants. She wanted to stick to a travel budget, while Eli wanted to feel carefree. Eli had been looking forward to a side trip into Costa Rica when he became ill and needed help, which apparently she did not do a good job of providing. Their time and money pooled. It wasn't so easy to part ways out of convenience. They spent many nights sleeping in separate beds, listening to the birds and the monkeys in the rainforest. The relationship ended soon after the trip. Eli and his girlfriend needed to be in like. By this, I mean two things: being alike in the ways that matter and genuinely liking who the other person is. Often these go hand in hand. That is because the more similar two people are, the more they are able to understand each other. Each appreciates how the other acts and how he or she goes about the day, and this forestalls an incredible amount of friction. Two people who are similar are going to have the same reactions to a rainy day, a new car, a long vacation, an anniversary, a Sunday morning, and a big party. We sometimes hear that opposites attract, and maybe they do for a hookup. More often, similarity is the essence of compatibility. Studies have repeatedly found that couples who are similar in areas such as socioeconomic status, education, age, ethnicity, religion, attractiveness, attitudes, values, and intelligence are more likely to be satisfied with their relationships and are less likely to seek divorce. Finding someone like you might seem easy, but there is a twist. Not just any similarity will do. Dating and married couples do tend to be similar to each other in attractiveness, age, education, political views, religion, and intelligence. So what about all those divorces out there? What about Eli and his girlfriend? The problem is, while people are good at matching themselves and others on relatively obvious criteria, such as age and education, it turns out that these qualities are what researchers call deal breakers, not matchmakers. Deal breakers are your own personal sine qua non in relationships. They are qualities, almost always similarities, you feel are non-negotiable. The absence of these similarities allow you to weed out people with whom you have fundamental differences. Maybe it is a deal breaker if someone is not Christian because you want to share spirituality and community. Perhaps you cannot imagine being with someone who is not intellectually curious because you value enriching conversation in your relationships. Sometimes people can even agree to disagree about very apparent circumscribed differences, like Republican-Democrat couples who joke about their mixed marriages. Either way, people decide for themselves early on what their own deal breakers are, and typically we select partners accordingly. But these conspicuous similarities are not matchmakers. They may bring us together, but they don't necessarily make us happy. One matchmaker to consider is personality. Some research tells us that, especially in young couples, the more similar two people's personalities are, the more likely they are to be satisfied with their relationship. Yet personality is how dating and even married couples tend to be least alike. The likely reason for this is, unlike deal breakers, personality is less obvious and not as easy to categorize. Personality is not about what we have done or even about what we like. It is about how we are in the world, and this infuses everything we do. Personality is the part of ourselves that we take everywhere, even to Nicaragua, so it is worth knowing something about. The Big Five. Several years ago, I started to notice some particularly well-matched couples in my practice and in my social circle. People who, no matter how quirky or complex, had found someone who seemed similarly quirky and complex. When these couples would tell their stories about finding each other, the punchline was always, "We met online," and everyone around would say, "Isn't that amazing?" The more I learned about what exactly they meant, the less amazing it seemed. These couples weren't talking about meeting in chat rooms or posting personal ads. They were talking about being matched online. While some internet dating sites are nothing more than electronic bulletin boards for personals and photos, others purportedly assess your personality and pair you with similar others. These sorts of sites say they are more concerned with who you are than with what you want. This is good. The "what you want" questions bring us back to the deal breakers: hobbies, religion, politics, and other similarities that, while convenient, may not actually make us happy. The "who you are" questions or about profiling your personality. Some research suggests that couples who are matched through this sort of service tend to be happier than couples who meet in other ways. And if these matching sites are pairing people based on their personality profiles, then this makes some sense. I understand that the success of online dating sites is as variable as their methods. Besides, not everyone is interested in meeting on the internet. Nevertheless, I do like that this sort of approach brings personality to the forefront sooner rather than later, during dating rather than during divorce counseling. That's something everyone ought to do and something that everyone can do. You don't need a fancy test to think about your personality or anyone else's. One of the simplest and most widely researched models of personality is what is called the Big Five. The Big Five refers to the five factors that describe how people interact with the world: openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, neuroticism. Just by reading about the Big Five and considering your own behavior, it is pretty easy to tell whether you fall on the high end or the low end, or somewhere in the middle of the five dimensions. The Big Five is not about what you like, it is about who you are. It is about how you live. The Big Five tells us how you wake up in the morning and how you go about doing most anything. It has to do with how you experience the world and, as a result, how others experience you. This is important because when it comes to personality, wherever you go, there you are. Consider that where we are on the Big Five is about 50% inherited. This means that you came into this world with roughly half of who you are already in place because of genes, prenatal influences, and other biological factors. While you learn to interact with the world somewhat differently as experiences make their mark, personality remains relatively stable over time. Any parent can attest to the power of personality. David has been that way since the day he was born. Or about siblings, Avery and Hannah have been completely different since day one. The Big Five. Openness. Being low on openness is being practical, conventional, preferring routine, being skeptical, rational, and shying away from new things. Being high on openness is being open to new experiences, being intellectually curious, creative, imaginative, adventurous, and insightful. Conscientiousness. Being low in conscientiousness is being relaxed about standards, being easygoing, careless, spontaneous, and even being prone to addiction. Being high in conscientiousness is being disciplined, efficient, organized, responsible, dutiful, self-directing, thorough, and controlling. Extroversion. Being low in extroversion is liking solitary time, being shy, reserved, being energized by being alone, being quiet, independent, cautious, and aloof. Being high in extroversion is being outgoing, enthusiastic, active, novelty-seeking, getting energy from interactions with others, and being talkative. Agreeableness. Being low in agreeableness is to be uncooperative, antagonistic, suspicious, and having trouble understanding others. Being high in agreeableness is to be cooperative, kind, affectionate, friendly, compassionate, trusting, compliant, and understanding. Neuroticism. Being low in neuroticism is to be not easily bothered by things, to feel secure, to take things at face value, and to be emotionally resilient. Being high in neuroticism is to feel tense, moody, anxious, sensitive, being prone to sadness, prone to worrying a lot, and quickly seeing the negative. When you figure out your highs, mediums, and lows, you have a general profile of your personality, one that should describe your behavior across different situations and times. You can do the same for anyone that you know well or are starting to know well, and this will bring into relief how similar or dissimilar your personalities are. There is no right or wrong personality. There is just your personality and how it fits with the personalities of other people. While it is not better or worse to be high or low or in the middle of the dimensions of the Big Five, it is often the case that we like or dislike people because of the way their extremes compare to our own. From what I could tell, Eli didn't party too much. It also didn't sound like Eli's girlfriend was clinically depressed. Sometimes the only thing wrong with another person is that he or she is a poor match for your own personality. From what we know in this chapter, we can see that Eli is very active and approaching. He likes getting up early and heading out into the world. He's often in a good mood, and he loves loud stories, but does not care for time constraints or routines. This tells me Eli is relatively high on openness and extroversion, but somewhat low on conscientiousness and neuroticism. We can only see Eli's girlfriend through his eyes, but he described her as someone who, largely in contrast to himself, is withdrawing and responsible. It takes her a while to warm up to new situations, but once she is involved in something, she can be very focused and goal-oriented. She sounds like the opposite of Eli, low on openness and extroversion, but high on conscientiousness and neuroticism. Fortunately, Eli and his girlfriend both sounded high on agreeableness, which probably had a lot to do with why they stayed together as long as they did. Eli and his girlfriend did not understand each other. They were fooled into thinking they were compatible because they had many plain sight commonalities. They felt confused as their dissimilar personalities continually clashed. Not sure what to make of this, each hoped the other might change. Both imagined that they might become more similar the longer they were together. But the evidence for personality convergence over time is mixed. Sometimes dating or married couples decide to split because things change, someone cheated or had to move. But more often, people split up because things don't change. It is far more common to hear couples say that in retrospect, the differences were there all along. When and if you commit, chances are that you will choose someone who is similar to you in ways that are convenient. But long-term relationships are inevitably inconvenient. Psychologist Daniel Gilbert calls them the gateway to hard work, as they open the door to mortgages, children, and the like. Personality tells us something about how you and your partner will go about the good and bad days together. Your big five won't match exactly, of course, but the more similar your personalities, the smoother things may be. And for all of the ways you may not be like someone you love, by knowing something about his or her personality, you have the opportunity to be more understanding about why he or she does the very different or annoying things that he or she does. That goes a long way toward bridging differences, and that's important too. My boyfriend has an engagement ring in the drawer at his apartment, Courtney said the first time she sat down on my couch. I'm 28, and I want to get married, I think. But I feel like I've been diving behind furniture, avoiding moments he could propose, because I don't know if I want to say yes. Oh, I said, sitting up straight in my chair, thinking how glad I was to be having this conversation before the wedding. Do you know why not? For approximately 5 minutes, Courtney dispensed with what was right about Matt. He was devoted to her, had a good job as a microbiologist, was handsome, had a good heart, was sexually in tune with her, worked hard to please her, and he loved her. Courtney enjoyed being with Matt. He made her happy, and she loved him. Then, over the next several sessions, I heard what was wrong about Matt. Maybe he wasn't tall enough. Sometimes he wasn't funny enough at parties. He didn't like to talk about life as much as she did. He didn't bring her lilies on her birthday, even though her best friend told him to. He wasn't the best dresser. His mother kept sending corny scrapbooks she made from Matt and Courtney's online photos. Courtney gestured imploringly during most of her stories, but I noticed I did not find her complaints to be compelling. After a few weeks, I said, "I'm confused, Courtney. I've been listening to you carefully for some time now, and you seem clearly anxious and worked up. But I keep asking myself, are these foundational incompatibilities we're talking about, or are you not letting you and Matt be different?" Courtney's head snapped back. I could see my question surprised her. "But the cheesy scrapbooks, please," Courtney furthered, searching my face for the laughs it seemed she was used to getting. "What young couple doesn't have a closet full of crap from relatives?" I asked sincerely. Courtney's anxiety about Matt and about me grew. The same book had been sitting unread on Matt's nightstand for months. What did that mean? He didn't like to do things outdoors. What if he wasn't rugged enough? Meanwhile, she noticed she didn't like the way I started sessions by sitting silent, and my wedding ring made her wonder if I was too conservative to understand her point of view. Maybe she needed a new boyfriend and a new therapist, Courtney thought out loud. Maybe so, I acknowledged, but I had noticed Matt didn't sound as lame as she made him out to be. As a matter of fact, when she wasn't busy scanning for what might be wrong with him, the days and nights they spent together actually sounded quite nice. As I listened to Courtney, I spent some of the time thinking about the Big Five and relationships. Yet rather than wondering whether she and Matt were similar enough to be reasonably compatible, which it actually sounded like they were, I kept thinking of an even more robust research finding, that being on the high end of the neuroticism dimension is toxic for relationships. Neuroticism, or the tendency to be anxious, stressed, critical, and moody, is far more predictive of relationship unhappiness and disillusion than is personality dissimilarity. While personality similarity can help the years run smoothly, any two people will be different in some way or another. How a person responds to these differences can be more important than the differences themselves. To a person who runs high in neuroticism, differences are seen in a negative light. Anxiety and judgments about these differences then lead to criticism and contempt, two leading relationship killers. Courtney sometimes came to appointments armed with emails from her best friend, such as one that said she ought to run, not walk, and another that said she ought to refuse to settle for Matt. You don't have to marry Matt, but if you did, how would that be settling? I asked. Because he doesn't remember to bring me lilies. He doesn't read the newspaper. I mean, what does that say about his intellect? I thought he was quite successful as a microbiologist. Doesn't that say something about his intellect? Courtney ignored me and went on. Still, my best friend says the whole lilies thing is a bad sign. Is this friend married? I asked. No, Courtney replied. I flashed to a story of my own. My first child was born via cesarean section after I went into labor almost 3 days earlier. When it was all over, the doctors told me to cozy up to my new baby and to the button that dispensed pain medication. I would be able to eat in a day or so. Then they told my husband to go get some food for himself. A short time later, he came back to my hospital room with one piece of pizza, one beer, one chocolate chip cookie, and one ice cream sandwich. When I spotted his food, I was ready to scream. My aunt, who had come to the hospital to help with the baby, quickly whisked my husband out of the room and into the cafeteria. When she returned, it was simple for me to make a case against him. I would never visit some sick person in the hospital and chow down on my lunch while he or she sat there unable to eat. Surely this meant my life was changing because of the baby, while his was staying the same. My aunt listened for a while. Then she said gently, "Meg, honey, I think your standards are too high." "Yours are too low," I shot back, thinking of the nights my aunt cooked for my uncle before she went out to dinner with her friends, or of the times my uncle sat reading his book while she ran herself ragged. She was selling me out, I thought. Years later, I can see we were both right. My aunt is from a different generation, and she has accepted a division of labor that would not suit me. But I was being unfair to my husband. He'd been awake for 72 hours also. He'd stood by my side through labor and major surgery. He'd worried about the well-being of his wife and baby for days. The doctor did tell him to go eat, and he'd quickly brought his food back to the room so he could be with me. And the flowers were delivered just moments after he was ushered to the cafeteria. Now I chalk up my own bad behavior toward my husband and toward my aunt to pain and exhaustion, and to not recognizing that my husband and I were responding in different ways to being stressed. He made himself feel better by eating something yummy because he could. I got angry because I couldn't. That's all. I said to Courtney, "I'm thinking about all you have to say, both as a psychologist who knows the research and as a married person who knows what marriage is like. I'm not sure how germane lilies and soul-bearing talks will be to your relationship 10 years from now. Soon, life will be happening, and you'll probably be too busy and maybe even too happy to spend your time deconstructing it." "Hopefully," she chuckled. "I think it's easy to surround yourself with friends who are just like you. As a group, you may decide everyone else is doing it wrong. Friends can form a culture of criticism where differences are seen as deficiencies." "Okay. But sometimes differences are just differences. They can even be strengths." Research on long-term marriages suggests that what we need in marriage changes over time. It is a young couple's job to create a shared vision and a shared life. When this is the task, similarities can feel validating and comforting, and differences can feel threatening. By our 40s and beyond, as work, children, home, activities, extended family, and community come to the fore, marriage is typically less couple-centered. When couples are juggling more than dinners and shared weekends, a diversification of skills and interests can be helpful. Differences can keep life fresh. So you're telling me not to be picky? I'm challenging you to be picky about things that might matter in 20 years, such as extreme differences in values or goals or personality, or whether you love each other. But the differences you're sounding off about seem like everyday discrepancies that are a part of any real relationship. But that's the thing. How do I know if a relationship is hard because it's wrong or because it's real? You'll never know with complete certainty. That's why marriage is a commitment, not a guarantee. Then how can I ever choose someone? The same way you make any decision. You weigh the evidence and you listen to yourself. The trick for you is going to be to listen to what matters, not to every single thing that makes you dissatisfied or anxious. Okay. There will always be differences of some kind, but statistically speaking, that's not what will kill a relationship. It's what you do with the differences. Do you know what the differences are going in? Have you thought about how they will affect your life? Are you prepared to bridge or even accept them? Those questions make me really nervous. Then let's ask some different questions. Let's say you and Matt break up. What happens if that perfect match does not exist? Fair question. To continue being fair, let's try this the other way too. Let's say you keep looking and you find that perfect mate. What happens when you have a daughter or a son who isn't so perfect, who doesn't do things like you do? Back to criticism and contempt? Courtney added a joke. That, or the other day, I actually had a brief thought about adopting an older child so I can find the perfect match in a kid. I didn't laugh. I've worked with too many kids raised on criticism and contempt. Courtney suffered a severe knee injury from running. 2 months later, she hobbled back into my office on crutches, looking humbled. "I think I might want to marry Matt," she said. "Oh, really?" I said, surprised. "Yeah. I've had a lot of time to think. Matt has been amazing. He took off work and carted me to every doctor appointment and surgery you can imagine, and we had some really good talks during all this." "How wonderful." "The biggest talk came after my best friend sent me this big bunch of lilies. I was upset Matt didn't do something like that. He got angry and pointed out how she hadn't even been over to my apartment to help, but he'd done everything he could to take care of me. I realized Matt was right. He'd done everything for me, no complaints. I realized I'm the complainer, and he doesn't even complain about that." "Wow." I told him I saw the engagement ring in his drawer, and I thought I probably did want to get married, but I wanted some more time. He said he wants to surprise me and ask me when I'm not expecting it, but we agreed we would wait 1 year. "And what's the year for?" "I want to use this time to really look at my relationship with Matt and to look at myself." "I see," I said. "I came here because I thought Matt had to do all the changing if we were going to get married. Now I see that whether I decide to be with Matt or not, there are things I need to change about myself. I need to get my emotions under control. But what if I can't change? What if it's too late for me?" Courtney was realizing her personality was her real challenge, that that's what her work in therapy was going to be about. "It's not too late," I said. "But whatever it is you want to change about yourself, now is the time to change it." The brain and the body. Forward thinking. Life can only be understood backward, but it must be lived forward. Soren Kierkegaard, philosopher. The more you use your brain, the more brain you will have to use. George A. Dorsey, anthropologist. In 1848, Phineas Gage was a 25-year-old railway worker building the bed for the Rutland and Burlington Railroad in Vermont. On Wednesday, September 13th of that year, he and his crew were blasting through a rocky outcrop in order to create a flat surface for the rails. Gage's job was to drill holes in the rock, fill the holes with gunpowder, add sand, and then pack the sand and gunpowder down with a tamping iron. Later, fuses would be lit to explode the rock. The tamping iron was 3 feet long and about a quarter inch wide at the narrow end and about 1 inch wide at the fat end. At 4:30 p.m. on that day, Phineas Gage drilled a hole and added gunpowder. In this particular hole, he forgot to add sand. As he packed the gunpowder down with his tamping iron, sparks from the rod striking the rock ignited the gunpowder, causing an explosion that drove the tamping iron out of Gage's hand and through his head. The rod entered Gage's head point first under the left cheekbone. It passed behind the left eye socket and exited through the top of his skull. After the accident, Phineas Gage was, and was not, fine. To the amazement of his co-workers, Gage was alive and could talk. He rode upright in an ox cart to the nearest town and greeted the summoned physician with, "Doctor, here is business enough for you." Although in the mid-1800s, scientists were not sure how the brain worked, it was generally thought to be central to life and movement. But here was Phineas Gage, walking and talking with a hole through his head. After some time, Gage was examined by doctors at Harvard. He then traveled to New York City and around New England, where he told his story and displayed himself to curious onlookers. Over time, it became clear that not all was well with Phineas Gage. Those around him were so impressed he was alive, it took a while to notice he was no longer acting like himself. Before the accident, he had been a great favorite among friends, an efficient and capable worker, and in possession of temperate habits and a well-balanced mind. After the accident, he was suddenly wavering about plans for the future. Phineas Gage now said and did what he wanted with little concern for others or the consequences. His doctor concluded that the balance between his intellectual faculties and animal propensities seems to have been destroyed. His friends and family said he was so altered, he was no longer Gage. Gage's condition suggested that while the forward part of the brain may not have much to do with whether we live and breathe, it has a lot to do with how we act. It would be more than 100 years before scientists would understand how. After Gage's accident, scientists raced to map the brain. It was difficult to do research on humans, so as in the case of Phineas Gage, doctors had to rely on whatever injuries and illnesses came their way. This all changed in the 1970s when magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI, and then functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI, technology made it possible for doctors to look at the brain in vivo. A host of new technologies can now measure brain activity in living children and adults, and this has allowed researchers to better understand how the brain works. We now know that the brain develops from bottom to top and from back to front. This order reflects the evolutionary age of the areas of the brain. The oldest parts of the brain, the ones also present in our ancient ancestors and animal cousins, develop first, at the base of the brain, near the spine. They control breathing, senses, emotions, sex, pleasure, sleep, hunger and thirst, or the animal propensities left intact after Phineas Gage's injury. Roughly speaking, these areas are what we consider to be the emotional brain. The most forward part of the brain, literally and figuratively, is the frontal lobe, located just behind the forehead. The most recent part of the brain to have evolved in humans, it is also the final area of the brain to mature in each individual. Nicknamed the executive functioning center and the seat of civilization, the frontal lobe is where reason and judgment reside. It is where rational thoughts balance and regulate the feelings and impulses of the emotional brain. The area of the brain that processes probability and time, the frontal lobe is also where we tackle uncertainty. This allows us to think not only about the present, but also about the future. It is where we quiet our emotions long enough to anticipate the likely consequences of our behavior and plan accordingly for tomorrow, even though no outcome is certain and the future is unknown. This front part of the brain is where we do our forward thinking. Consider 20th and 21st century patients with frontal lobe damage, several of whom have been written about extensively. What stands out about these patients is that, although their intellect is unchanged and their ability to solve concrete problems remains intact, they show significant deficits in personal and social decision-making. They make choices in friends, partners, and activities that go against their own best interests. They find it difficult to see an abstract goal in terms of the concrete steps needed to reach it. They have trouble planning their days and their years. If this sounds familiar, it should. Modern advances and modern patients have largely solved the mystery of Phineas Gage. In the mid-1800s, it was inconceivable that someone could suffer a brain injury and live to tell about it, and that this same person could do some things, but not others. We now understand that Phineas Gage changed from thoughtful to reckless, from purposeful to vacillating, because the tamping rod had made a hole in his frontal lobe. 20-somethings might have little reason to care about Phineas Gage and the frontal lobe if not for researchers at the Laboratory of Neuroimaging at UCLA. From MRI scans of healthy adolescents and 20-somethings, we now know that the frontal lobe does not fully mature until sometime between the ages of 20 and 30. In our 20s, the pleasure-seeking emotional brain is ready to go, while the forward-thinking frontal lobe is still a work in progress. 20-somethings aren't brain damaged, of course, but because of the still-developing frontal lobe, they can be what psychologists call uneven. Many of my clients are confused by the fact that they went to good colleges, yet they don't know how to start the careers they want. Or they don't understand how they could have been valedictorians, but are unable to make decisions about whom to date and why. Or they feel like fakes because they managed to get good jobs, yet cannot calm themselves down at work. Or they can't figure out how 20-somethings who did not do as well in school are now outpacing them in life. These are different skill sets. Being smart in school is about how well you solve problems that have correct answers and clear time limits. But being a forward-thinking adult is about how you think and act even and especially in uncertain situations. The frontal lobe doesn't just allow us to coolly solve the problem of what exactly we should do with our lives. Adult dilemmas, which job to take, where to live, whom to partner with, or when to start a family, don't have right answers. The frontal lobe is where we move beyond the futile search for black and white solutions as we learn to tolerate and act on better shades of gray. The late maturing frontal lobe might seem like a good reason to postpone action, to wait until 30 after all to get started on a life. A recent newspaper article even suggested that maybe 20-something brains ought to afford them special services of some kind, but dumbing down the 20s is hardly the way to go. Forward thinking doesn't just come with age, it comes with practice and experience. That's why some 22-year-olds are incredibly self-possessed, future-oriented people who already know how to face the unknown, while some 34-year-olds still have brains that run the other way. To make sense of how people can develop so differently, it helps to know the rest of the story of Phineas Gage. Phineas Gage's post-injury life has largely been sensationalized. In textbooks, he is most often painted as a loser or freak who ran off and joined the circus, never regaining any semblance of normal life. Gage did briefly exhibit the tamping rod and himself at Barnum's American Museum, but more significant and less widely known is that before dying after a series of seizures nearly 12 years after the accident, Gage worked for many years as a stagecoach driver in New Hampshire and Chile. In this work, he rose early and readied himself. He prepared his horses and his coach for 4 a.m. daily departures. He drove passengers over rough roads for hours at a time. This is all at odds with the notion that Gage lived out his life as an impulsive slacker. Historian Malcolm McMillan suggests that Phineas Gage benefited from a sort of social recovery. The regular routines of stagecoach driving allowed Gage's frontal lobe to relearn many of the skills compromised in the accident. The experiences he had day in and day out allowed Gage to again be personally and socially deliberate, to again be forward-thinking. Thus, Phineas Gage provided doctors not only with some of the earliest information about the functional areas of the brain, but also with some of the earliest evidence of the brain's plasticity. Gage's social recovery and countless subsequent studies on the brain tell us that the brain changes in response to the environment. This is especially true in the 20-something years as the brain caps off its second and final growth spurt. By the time we reach our 20s, the brain has gotten as big as it's going to be, but it is still refining its network of connections. Communication in the brain takes place at the level of the neuron, and the brain is made up of about 100 billion of these, each of which can make thousands of different connections. Speed and efficiency are paramount and are the hard-won result of two critical periods of growth. In the first 18 months of life, the brain experiences its first growth spurt, producing far more neurons than it can use. The infant brain overprepares, readying itself for whatever life brings, such as to speak any language within earshot. This is how we go from being one-year-olds who understand fewer than 100 words to being six-year-olds who know more than 10,000. But this same rapid overproduction of neurons creates an overly crowded network, and this leads to cognitive inefficiency, which is not adaptive. That's why these same sponge-like toddlers struggle to string together a few words in a sentence, and they forget to put on their socks before their shoes. Potential and confusion rule the day. To make neural networks more efficient, this first growth spurt is followed by pruning. Across years, the brain keeps the neurons and connections that are used, while those that are neglected are pruned or allowed to die off. It was long thought that pruning continued in a linear fashion throughout life as the brain refined its neural network. But in the 1990s, researchers at the National Institute of Mental Health discovered that the process repeats itself in a second critical period, one that starts in adolescence and ends in the 20-something years. Again, thousands of new connections sprout, exponentially increasing our capacity for new learning. Only now the learning isn't about vocabulary or socks and shoes. Most of the thousands of new connections that sprout in adolescence do so in the frontal lobe, and again, the brain overprepares, but this time for the uncertainty of adult life. Early childhood may be the time for language, but evolutionary theorists say this critical period primes us to learn about the complex challenges of adulthood. How to find a professional niche, how to choose and live with a mate, how to be a parent, where and when to stake our claims. This last critical period is rapidly wiring us for adulthood. But how? In the same way that young children learn to speak English or French or Catalan or Chinese, whatever the environment offers up, in our 20s we are especially sensitive to whatever is within earshot. 20-something jobs teach us about regulating our emotions and negotiating the complicated social interactions that make up adult life. 20-something work and school are our best chance to acquire the technical, sophisticated skills needed in so many careers today. 20-something relationships are prepping us for marriage and other partnerships. 20-something plans help us think across the years and decades ahead. How we learn to cope with 20-something setbacks readies us for handling our spouses and bosses and children. We even know that larger social networks change our brains for the better as they require us to communicate with more and different others. As neurons that fire together wire together, the jobs we have and the company we keep are rewiring our frontal lobes, and these same frontal lobes are in turn making our decisions in the office and on Saturday nights. Back and forth it goes as work and love and the brain knit together in the 20s, to make us into the adults we want to be in our 30s and beyond. Or not. Because our 20s are the capstone of this last critical period, they are, as one neurologist said, a time of great risk and great opportunity. The post-20-something brain is still plastic, of course, but the opportunity is that never again in our lifetime will the brain offer up countless new connections and see what we make of them. Never again will we be so quick to learn new things. Never again will it be so easy to become the people we hope to be. The risk is that we may not act now. In a use-it-or-lose-it fashion, the new frontal lobe connections we use are preserved and quickened. Those we don't use just waste away through pruning. We become what we hear and see and do every day. We don't become what we don't hear and see and do every day. In neuroscience, this is known as survival of the busiest. 20-somethings who use their brains by engaging with good jobs and real relationships are learning the language of adulthood just when their brains are primed to learn it. In the chapters ahead, we will see how they learn to calm themselves down at work and in love, and this brings mastery and success. They learn to get along and get ahead, and this makes them happier and more confident. They learn to be forward-thinking before life's defining moments are in the rearview mirror. 20-somethings who don't use their brains become 30-somethings who feel behind as professionals and as partners, and as people as they miss out on making the most of life still to come. It is easy to feel overwhelmed by uncertainty, to want to lie low with the urban tribe or our parents, until our brains just mature on their own and somehow suddenly know the sure answers to our lives. But that's not how the brain works, and that's not how life works. Besides, even if our brains could wait, love and work can't. The 20s are indeed the time to get busy. It's forward thinking for an uncertain age. Calm yourself. When we try to do something new, we don't know what we're doing. That's the biggest challenge. Jeffrey Kalmykoff, designer. Blown about by every wind of criticism. Samuel Johnson, writer. On paper, what I do looks really, really good, but I really, really hate my job. That's what I heard through the phone, and tears. Just tell me I can quit. If I know I can quit, then I can make it one more day. Just tell me I can quit, that I won't be doing this forever. You definitely won't be doing this forever, and of course you can quit, but I don't think you should. Sniff. Danielle was a former client who, after working her way through a web of internships and contacts, had become the assistant to one of the biggest names in television news. For a brief moment, she thought she had it made. Within a few weeks, she felt worse than ever. We resumed our weekly sessions, this time over the phone. She called every Monday morning at 8 a.m. from New York City, as she braved heading into the office. Danielle's job was a cross between The Devil Wears Prada and Entourage. Her boss yelled at her almost every day, usually because Danielle failed to be omniscient. How dare Danielle not know that Mr. X is always put right through on the phone? And why did Danielle not foresee that her boss might be bumped from first class? Worst was when her boss ventured beyond New York City in his own car and got lost amongst the townships of Connecticut or New Jersey. He would call Danielle at the office and scream into the phone, "Where the hell am I?" As if Danielle could possibly know, sitting at her desk on the verge of what felt like a panic attack. Danielle's situation may seem extreme or somehow unlikely. Her boss sounded more like a movie character than a real person. But he was a real person, and so is Danielle. We all have these stories. When I was a graduate student, one of my supervisors was a renowned clinician. It was an honor to be assigned to her, yet I'd heard she was a busy lady who had a problem with multitasking. According to departmental lore, she favored doing supervision in her car as she drove all over town, picking up her dry cleaning and stopping by the bank. This year would be different, the clinic director told me. The supervisor was under strict orders not to leave her office during the supervision hour. How bad could it be? Our weekly meeting was just after lunch on Tuesdays. The supervisor usually hurried late into her office, carrying a satchel stuffed full of the things she was going to do, besides listen to me. Sometimes it was knitting, other times she sent faxes or dusted her office. Once she had someone come in to reupholster her couch. One afternoon after we sat down, I watched her reach into her satchel, wondering what it would be this time. First, she pulled out a bag of onions, then a cutting board, then a butcher's knife. For our entire hour, she chopped onions on the cutting board on her lap as I told her about my clients, and she gave me her input. She never once looked my way except at the end of the session to say, "Time's up." Only then did she notice the tears streaming down my face, mostly because of the onions, but probably partly because of how I felt. "Oh, was this bothering you?" she asked. All I could do was smile and say, "What are you making?" Apparently, my supervisor was having a dinner party. She had sessions that stretched into the early evening, so was doing the food prep at her office. As I said goodbye, I acted as if this were the most normal thing in the world. Maybe it was. We all have difficult, even outlandish work experiences we have to find a way through. When 20-somethings enter the workforce, and I mean really enter the workforce, by getting a job that isn't safe or easy, they are in for a shock. With no freshman class to huddle in, they may find themselves all alone at the absolute bottom. At the top may be bosses like Danielle's, who were in positions of power because of their talent or experience, rather than their managerial skills or even their GPAs. Some bosses are not interested in being mentors. Others don't know how. These very same bosses are often the ones who are tasked with teaching 20-somethings how to navigate the brand new world of work. It may be a match made in hell, but that's the way it is. As one human resources professional said to me,